Now, here's what tends to happen, and you know this, science. Mm. We'll get a progressive voice in politics every now and then, like a Bernie Sanders or like an AOC, mm. who'll come along and who will be talking about the problem with concentrated wealth in America.
Yeah.
The problem with having one of the richest nations in the world with people living on the street. They don't have a roof over their head. They don't have enough food to eat. They can't afford to elevate themselves or their children because the cost of schooling is too great. Right. In other words, we'll get an AOC to come along every so often that calls attention to the whole range of issues that are tied to a diagnosis that's mm-hmm. rooted in the problem with concentrated wealth. Yeah. Now, they seem to then have a conflict because on the one hand, they're going to be constituents that want to get behind them, that want to push them to deal with these race specific remedies that are linked to a diagnosis that's rooted in the foundational evil, they might say, of white supremacy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Versus a diagnosis, as Du Bois might put it, that talks about not so much color caste or not merely color caste, but color caste for profit.
Yeah.
And see the quest for profit and uncontrolled and unconstrained wealth for the few as the primary diagnosis that needs a remedy. Speak to this, science. What do they do with this?
We gonna be in so much trouble. So it's like, what's interesting though about the pivot, right? It's just like, it gets back to the question of what is the singular harm?
Mm.
Is the singular harm racism and white supremacy, or is the singular harm capitalism?
Mm.
And do those two interact in ways? And which ways should we privilege a prognosis and a means to redress that particular problem? Because if you're focused on the racism and white supremacism, and that's going to determine the way in which you're going to try to remedy the harm, but you're leaving intact the, let's say, the wealth concentration generated by capitalism that basically has used racism in particular ways to kind of like shelter and hide itself, then we'd have the wrong diagnosis, we'd be led to the wrong means, and we wouldn't resolve the problem. I mean, but the minute we start talking about black reparations, we've already limited it and taken a particular framing, as opposed to saying, we need to repair America from the damage done by capitalism. Mm. And that might involve reparations going to white folks in Appalachia. It might involve going to white folks that suffered from deindustrialization in Flint. And that's going to be like a huge conversation because everyone, they hear the word reparations and like black is implied in front of it.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, man, this is a handful. And it makes me think about, some of it makes me think about my younger self, my recently departed aunt. I called her Aunt Rain. She had a nickname for me when I was growing up, called me Splozak. And and so I'm sitting here thinking about Splozak right now. I was actually born in the Boogie Down in one of the poorest districts in the country. I was born in Park Chester General Hospital. It's no longer there, but it's an area in the Bronx. And but I grew up, you know, in the iconic Queensbridge public housing projects.
Mm.
And I tell my kids this, I don't think they fully appreciate it all the time, but they're basically the first generation in my family that will not have lived or spent any real time in public housing.
Damn.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, and the thing is, science, like both of my parents grew up in the same projects, and their parents made the great migration that eventually landed them in Queensbridge. And on my mother's side, you know, the family was one of the first Black families in Queensbridge Public Housing, and, you know, not long after it opened. Damn. And man, growing up there, man, we have family struggles with all the things that many families in disadvantaged circumstances struggle with, including drug addiction, death of family members because of AIDS, incarceration, you know, dire poverty, violence, abuse in the home, just something I had to deal with, unfortunately, like so many other people, psychological and physical. And it's funny, man, I think about Splozak and all the times he spent in the River Park looking out across the East River past Roosevelt Island, across the 59th Street Bridge into Manhattan, looking at the bright lights. And, you know, for me, man, it's like the class stuff was always more salient rather than the race stuff, because like everybody in the projects was poor. You know, I had one of my partners, Gilberto, lived in my building, Spanish Cat, had a couple of white neighbors, not very many, but nobody had ducats. Everybody was struggling with like just being in public housing and all that meant. And I think it had a lot to do with why I think from the beginning, I was thinking about like whiteness, white supremacy, but more so thinking about it as playing a functional role in America and globally. And I didn't have the words to sort of express this then, but you know, Splozak, the young Splozak was philosophical from day one. You know, that's what I tried to lay out on the TED Talk doing the knowledge science. And the two main functions as I saw it was white supremacy basically was a way to tell a story about white superiority that served to divide poor and working people, to keep them from coming together to put democratic government to work for achieving a more just, humane, and healthy world for everybody. Damn. And the second function it served is to prevent us from coming together to abolish concentrated wealth. Yeah. And a system of tax breaks for the rich that enabled them to avoid paying their fair share of taxes and allowed them to pass off their money to their kin and to future generations. And so for me, like the orientation was never just like, yeah, white supremacy, racism is the root of all of our problems. It was like, no, that's being used, one, to disempower us, and two, to basically keep us financially insecure. So, science, what are people going to say, for example, if you and I get together, as we plan to do, and think about how progressive reform is really going to require radically restructuring the U.S. tax code? What kind of names are they going to call us? Are they going to tell us it's impractical? Are they going to say it cuts at the core of what it is to be an American, that is, cuts against that, which is about working your way up the ladder or out of the projects, in my case, by hard work, grit, determination, creating some wealth for yourself and your family and passing it on to your kids so that they can live well or even better than we did. What they going to say when we say, hey, yeah, people have been talking about cutting checks, circulating them, but what if we do something more? What if we say, hey, we need to really rethink this tax code and how it allows us to transfer wealth? What they going to say, friends?
I mean, clearly we would then be some version of socialists. Clearly we'll be called impractical or naive. But I think what we need to do is we need to find some way of navigating past these labeling shortcuts. Socialism, impractical, Democrat, Republican. It's like they're now comfortable, but they're not necessarily informative. I mean, we talk about politics all the time, but the alternatives are not known because some of these shortcuts are like conversation stoppers, basically. They just suspend interaction. I think what we're talking about here, though, is I think we're trying to create and communicate a new way to talk about problems that exist around us, a new way to talk about where we go, and a new way to talk about how we get there. in a way that both informs as well as invites use. I mean, the basics of the Ptolemy bit, right? It's like we're discussing politics, economics, and culture, but essentially each one of those is on a dimension, right? Where it's like it's restrictive, narrow, and authoritarian on one end and open, wide, and democratic on the other, but politically, economically, and culturally. And that, I think, is a different way of thinking, right? So then we talk about, you're a narrow politics person, or you're an expansive culturalist. I mean, we need to change the way that we talk about people, and then even get away from, like, you know, forget talking about, like, you know, isms, right? We'd be like, oh, you're an economics, politics, culture person, or you're a culture politics person. We need to basically kind of identify in a precise manner exactly who people are and what they're trying to advocate, and get away from these labels that stop conversation. Someone starts to do something, the minute they're called a communist, a socialist, or anarchist, it's done. We're done listening, most folks. And so we need to get to the particularities of what people are saying and how they're saying it, and then acknowledge that also we not only have three topics, politics, economics, and culture, but we have like three different slices at it. We got your diagnosis of the problem, the prognosis of where you want to go, and the means to get there. And those could have different levels of emphasis, right? And so that's a lot, but I think we need to get to that point, or we're just, because basically I think we're stuck, man. I mean, I think we're just stuck, and basically we can't get to resolving our problems or even talking about them because these blockages exist to kind of like getting us to deeper understanding. You can cut education and you can like start to stigmatize people with labels, but you know, I don't think we should care. And speaking of not caring, I'm like, I don't care about being impractical. I mean, like, you know, breaking free from Britain wasn't impractical at the time, but necessary. I mean, ending slavery was impractical at the time. Giving women the right to vote was impractical at the time. Forget impracticality. Let's get to efficiency. Let's get to resolving these problems.